So the 10th chapter, which is called Vibhuti Yoga, Arjuna asks the Lord, where can I see you in this world? I don't want to see you after death. I don't want you to tell me I am the unmanifest, subtle, all-pervading consciousness, Brahman, everywhere. That is very hard. And even for us who are at, like Arjuna, it is hard for us to conceptualize this substratum of the universe, the all-pervading consciousness. Just as when we see a pot, we admire the beauty of the pot, but it is hard for us to visualize all the mud that is there in the entire universe, all in the earth and all the other planets. Everything is that one mud. And this is even more subtle because it's not visible. We cannot see it. We cannot taste it. We cannot touch it. Brahman is something that I cannot even conceptualize with my intellect. And so how am I to see you? Arjuna says, O Lord, please tell me, how can I see you in the world so that seeing you in the world, I may then turn my attention to you as the substratum of the whole universe. So it is like we go from the form to the formless, just as we see the form of the Lord in the temple or the church. We see Krishna or Shiva or Jesus or Buddha, whatever form you see, and you fall in love with that form, that this is my beloved Lord. And that is very nice. And it is okay to continue to love the Lord in the form, because it is, love is a very powerful, potent force. Because unless you love something, you are not going to want to possess it, want to acquire it. But then that love should then extend to all beings, that the Lord, this my deep beloved Lord who has created me, has created all the beings. And he is everywhere. He is in all the forms. Krishna is there in Jesus, and he is in Muhammad, and he is in Allah. So everything is that one consciousness, and every being is that one consciousness. So you start with the form and continue to have love for the form, but then also see the form as everywhere. So that's how you slowly progress in your understanding, in your thinking. So he wants to know, where are you? So in last week, we had studied a few examples where he says, where I am. And today we'll do a few more examples. So the idea is that through these 75 examples, the Lord is telling us that when you go out into the world, you can see me. And then when you remember me in the form, then you remember me as the Lord of the universe. So verse number 25. In chapter 10, verse number 25. Maharshinam bhriguraham giramasmekam aksharam yajnanam japa yajnyosmi sthavaranam himalayah. So he says, Maharshi, in the verse number 25, among Maharshis, among the great rishis, among the great realized sages, I am Bhrigu. Now who was Bhrigu? Bhrigu, there are different stories, but the one that appeals to me is that there was a great demon king named Nahusha. He was very, very powerful. He was so powerful that he had so much power that he not only conquered the whole earth and the lower worlds, but he also conquered the heavens. And he drove Indra out of his palace, and he was in charge of all the heavens. And he was a very wicked ruler, you know, very dictatorial, and he just was persecuting all the good people and everybody. And he became so arrogant, and as it happens, when you become over-arrogant, sometimes buddhi brushed ho jati, his mind got deluded. And he said that I'm going to ride in a palanquin, you know, like where four people carry. I'm going to ride in a palanquin carried by four men throughout my palace. I'm not going to walk on my feet. I am too great to walk on. So they said, okay. But then one day he said, you know, these rishis, these mahatmas, these monks, they don't do anything. They waste their time and they give wrong ideas to the people. Let me use them as my travelers. So he asked four rishis to carry him, you know, four, you know, respected sages. And they were carrying him in the palanquin. And the rishis are beyond ego. They said, okay, if that's what is required, we'll just do it. They didn't get upset or angry. They said, okay, if we are supposed to carry, we will carry. It so happened that Bhrigu was one of those four, and he was one of the great Sapta Rishis, one of the great seven Rishis, and he was shorter than the other three. And so as they were walking, he was the shortest, so he was, you know, the palanquin was crooked. The other three were tall, and so he was walking, and Nahusha got angry thinking that he's purposely making the palanquin shake, so he whipped him. And, you know, that cannot be a bigger crime than to, you know, persecute a divine person. And so Bhrigu, then he said, enough is enough. You know, it's not that he was personally hurt, but he felt that for the benefit of the universe, I have to put a stop to this. He's going to extreme. So he turned and he looked at him, you know, just by one look, Nahusha was burnt to ashes. You know, that much power these rishis had, that if they could direct their attention. So the idea being that he says that among the rishis, I am Bhrigu, because he was so divine and so humble, at the same time had so much power. Among the ginam, asmi, ekam, aksharam. Among the words, I am the one syllable. And what is the one syllable? That's om. And om is the one. Actually, om, we can talk for a whole hour. You don't need another, you know, you don't need to study anything else. There is so much in Om. I was reading just a couple of the Upanishads. In so many Upanishads, Om is covered. It's covered in Mandukya Upanishad. It's covered in Mundaka. It is even covered in Kaivalya Upanishad, which we will be doing in the Thursday class after Gita chapter 6. And the praise of Om and the symbolism of Om is so much that we can talk about it. So I thought we'll spend some time talking about it. So when we chant Om, Om is said to be a sound symbol. Just as, say, I ask you, think of a camel. Now, when I say think of a camel, in your mind, you immediately get a vision of a camel that is crooked, has, you know, these funny legs and walks in the desert and so on. But say, if you have never seen a camel and you have never been to Arabia in the desert and you don't know what a camel looks like, and I say think of a camel, and you won't know what to think. You know, you won't get an image. And then I have to spend a whole paragraph, you know, or two paragraphs, has two humps and has long legs and it's brown. And no matter how much I try, I cannot explain to you camel adequately until I ultimately will say, look, here's a picture, see it. So they say, a picture is worth 1,000 words. So I can show you a picture of camel, but it becomes very hard to describe a camel. But if once you have seen it, then you say, camel, I know what it looks like. You don't need to explain any further. So, Om is a word symbol that represents Brahman, that represents consciousness, that represents the substratum of the whole universe. That's why in the Upanishads, God is referred as Brahman. Brahman is neutral. It's neither male nor female, because it is the energy, it is the consciousness, it is the substratum. That's why we say God is neither, it's both. Can be male, you can worship God as Shiva, you can worship God as Saraswati, you can worship God as, or you can worship God as the support or the substratum of this universe. So, Om is a sound symbol that represents Brahman. And they say Om was the first sound. Even in the Bible it says, you know, God was alone and the Word was with Him. When they say the Word was with Him, they mean the sound symbol. The sound. So it is said that when the creation first started, the first sound that came was Om. And in fact, these rishis, when they are in deep meditation, when you go into that silence, you can hear that same sound of Om. And that sound is there in the whole universe. If you go to a brook, you know, a stream along the river, and you close your eyes and you hear the soft sound, you can hear the sound of Om. If you go to the ocean and you hear the waves. So Om is the support of the whole universe. And they say that all the world's languages, everything started with Om. So Om has a lot of significance. That's why when we begin our prayers, when we end our, you know, any studies, any rituals, any prayers, we start and end with Om. And all our mantras also start with Om. Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So Om is a very powerful sound, and chanting the name of Om. That's why when we say Om three times, you should not just say Om, 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 not like that. But think of that it is the Lord's name. And what we say in our scriptures, the Lord has thousands of names. That's why we have Vishnu Sahasranama and Shiva Sahasranama and Lalita Sahasranama. We have thousands of names of the Lord, and one of those names is Om. And same way, the Lord can be called Allah or Father in heaven or Buddha, but it is the, all of them represent that one consciousness. Now, what does Om represent in this chart? In the Mandukya Upanishad, the Om has been broken up into A, U, Ma. Actually, Om is not actually O-M. It is Om. You know, we extend it. So it's A, U, Ma. A is the first letter in any alphabet, whether you go to English or Spanish or Hindi or Telugu or Tamil. Every language in the world, the first letter is always A. Not only that, no letter can be made without A. A is the support. Like you say, ka, kha, ga, gha, they're all A. So, A is the support. So, A is the first letter. But also, A, U, M represent the three states, waking, dream, and deep sleep. Because the individual goes through three states of experience. Either I'm awake, or I'm dreaming, or I'm in deep sleep. Hopefully, no one else here is in the third state. But anyway... Hopefully you are all here. But so the waking state and the dream and the deep sleep are represented by A-U-M. But then when we chant Om, we don't go Om, 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 Om. You have silence. Om. And then you give a short break. And then you chant the next Om. So that silence is called the Turiya state. The state of realization. When a person realizes the truth, he is said to be, or she is said to be, in the Turiya state, where that person experiences complete silence. His mind is completely quiet and he's in that silence. Silence does not mean it is dead. It is means that there is no disturbance. That's why they say in Brahman, there is all silence, all peace, and all the whole universe is just disturbances arising, just as at the depth of the ocean. When you go to the depth, it is very quiet, very peaceful. There is nothing. Not even light penetrates. But as you come to the surface, you see all the activities. So the Turiya represents the silence, and the AUM represents the disturbance. That's why when you are chanting Om, there is a silence. And in that silence, the sound arises, Om, and then merges back into silence. Any sound, like I'm speaking right now, before I started speaking, this room was silent. After a while, hopefully I'll stop speaking, and then, then the room will again become silent. So that silence is the substratum. So the Turiya is the substratum, and A-U-M are included in that Turiya. So all the sounds are included in the silence because it is the source of the sound, and then the sound merges, just as the ocean is the source of the waves and the waves merge into the ocean. So that is one meaning of Om, that it represents the waking, dream, and deep sleep. And then in the Mandukya Upanishad, in the earlier verses, in the first verse, it says Om is also Brahman. And Brahman is not only waking, dream, and deep sleep, but it is past, present, and future. So anything, he says that, the teacher in the Mandukya said, anything that you see in this universe is Om. Because everything is Brahman. Everything is that consciousness. And Om and Brahman are the same. Just as when I say Krishna, and then you see his form playing the flute, or when you say, I say Jesus, and you see the form on the cross, the form is not separate from the name. The name and the form are one. So when I say Om, that means Om is Brahman. Om is that consciousness. And it is. And it says in that first mantra, it says all the waking, dream, and deep sleep, all the past, present, and future, and whatever you see here, everything is Om, everything. So all objects, all in the world, all objects, all emotions, all thoughts, all bodies, all minds, all intellects, all vasanas, all desires, all egos, everything is that Om, that one consciousness. So that's why when we chant Om, it has a lot of meaning, a lot of power. And when you chant Om, your mind, when you chant Om correctly, it tunes your mind to that, to those celestial vibrations. That's why these rishis, they used to chant Om, and in their silence, they heard all the vibrations, and that's from where all the Vedas came. All the scriptures, the Vedas came because the rishis in their meditation heard it. So in their silence, they heard. So that's why the Vedas are not composed by man. That's why we call them Shrutis. That means they were heard. The rishis heard them in their meditation, and then they just told them to the student, and then the student told it to the student. Finally, until Ved Vyas Ji was the one who actually put them to the pen and wrote them down. So all that you see is Om. Now, how can we reach that Brahman? How can I reach God? You know, because we say God is very difficult. They say you have to take years of tapas, and he's all formless. How can I know him? So in the Mundaka Upanishad, there's a very beautiful mantra. Two mantras, actually. And according to Swami Chinmayananda, these two mantras have the essence of the entire spiritual study. He says you only need to read and study these two mantras. Once you have studied, you don't need to read any books. You don't need to read anything. So that is the power of those two mantras. And I was actually going through that last night, and it's very, very powerful. But I'll summarize them. So it says that Brahman should be the target. Brahman is the target. And who is wanting to reach Brahman? That is me. The individuality. I, the individuality. But the individuality, the in person who wants to achieve the truth, who wants to realize Brahman, should have a few qualities. And one of them is he should be, or she should be, self-controlled. Should have control over their mind, control over their senses, and should have a firm determination that is what I want to be. I want to know Brahman. I want to realize the truth. It should not be, you know, what Swami Tejomayananda Ji, he calls it a pajama personality. You know, dila dhala. Theek hai, Brahman mil gaya to theek hai, nahi mila to theek hai, Bhagwan kabhi na kabhi mil jayega. Not that kind of attitude. You know, if I get God, it's okay. If I don't get, it's okay. How does it matter? It's not like that. You have to have the drive and the determination. Om is the bow. In the olden days, they used to, you know, have the bow and arrow. They didn't have guns and atomic bombs and all. But actually, they did. Actually, in our scriptures, they describe all these bombs and missiles and all they used to have in the war. But generally, people shot with a bow and arrow. So they say Om is the bow, the individual is the arrow, and the target is Brahman. The goal is Brahman. So what it means, see, like when you pull the bow, you know, the archer pulls the bow towards himself and then releases the arrow. And the arrow is pulled with the bow, and then it's released, and if it is shot properly, it bangs into the target and penetrates the target. So similarly, Om is the bow, which means that the individual should pull his mind towards Om. Should keep it. You can come in the front here. So the mind should be constantly focused on the symbol Om. And when you use the support of Om, when you use Om as your support, then Om is the support that can take you directly to Brahman, where you penetrate, where you become one with him. And that is what they mean, that the individual, once he realizes the truth of Brahman, he becomes one with it. It does not mean that the person becomes zero. No, the person becomes a great prophet. He becomes Jesus. He becomes Swami Chinmayananda. He becomes Buddha, Shankaracharya. Because his little individuality, the perceiver, feeler, and thinker dissolves, And that individual becomes one with that consciousness. That's why Jesus said, the Father in heaven and I are one. Because he understood that truth. And all these great Mahatma, Shankaracharya, he preached the Vedantic philosophy that there is Advaita. There is no two. In fact, there is only one. Even at this moment, even though we think ourselves to be separate from God, in fact, we are swimming in him. We are part of him. We are not separate from him. It is our ignorance, our ego, our avidya, is the vasanas that actually separate us. So God is not far away. He is speaking at this moment through me. He is listening through all of you. So God is not far away, but use the support of Om and chant the mantra with devotion and constant repetition, which he will talk about in the next one. Constant chanting and remembering the Lord. And then, of course, not only remembering, but bringing him, the Lord, into all your activities. Serve the world, constantly love everybody, get the right knowledge from meeting Mahatmas and saints and all the teachers that come. So through service, through love, through knowledge, and through constant determined effort, it can be reached. So it's not far away. It's not difficult. It is with us. God is with us all time. He's not far away. We just have to turn towards him and know him and remember him. That's what he says. Remember me and I am always with you. So this is the beauty of Om. Actually, there is a lot more we can talk, but I thought I'll just briefly talk about Om. So he says, Giram asmi ekam aksharam. I am that one syllable Om. Yajna nam japa yajnyosmi. Among all the sacrifice, I am japa yajna. I am the sacrifice of japa. Now what is japa? Japa is the chanting of the name of the Lord. And in all the religions, they have it. Even in Christianity, you know, they do the beads. You know, they do the beads. Even in Hinduism, all the different sects talk. You know, they say you have to carry a mala and you keep on chanting the mala. As you chant the name, you move one bead, and as you chant the name. So the idea being that the chanting of the name and the moving of the beads makes your mind more attentive. Even in Islam, they talk about carrying, you know, these beads. So all the main religions, even Buddhism, they talk about. So chanting the name of the Lord has a lot of power, because when you put your mind to it and chant with constant attention, then your mind becomes saturated with that Lord. This reminds me of a beautiful story. It's a nice story. There was this man who was very, very poor, extremely poor, lived alone, and he just did some manual work. Sometimes he didn't even have enough to eat. But he was very devoted, and there was a saint who lived outside the village in a small hut. And every day the man would take him food. Even if he didn't have, he would somehow get from somewhere. And it was his job. The saint used to eat only one time, and he said, I have taken responsibility. Sometime he would not eat himself, but he would make sure the master got fed. And so every day he did that. And so the master came to know that this person is very poor and needs help. And he said, okay, you know what I can do? I'm very pleased with your devotion. With my yogic powers, I can create you a genie. So he said, oh yeah, genie, what will it do? He said, the genie will give you anything you want. Anything you want. He said, anything? Yeah, anything from earth to heaven, whatever you want. He said, oh, that's very good. I would love to have it, because I'm poor, and that way I can bring food for you every day. I don't have to hunt. I'll ask the genie to bring me food. He said, yeah, you can do that. But there is only one condition, that you have to keep the genie busy 24 hours a day. If you don't give him work, the genie will eat you up. He said, that's not a problem. I have so much work in my house. I have so much for the genie to do. Don't worry. You please give it to me. I'm very thankful. So he bows down to the feet. So he chants the mantra, and out of this appears this mystical genie. And he's, you know, and he says, Master, I need some work. So he says, okay, follow me. So he's follow. Give me some work. He says, okay, bring me food. So he brings him all the world's food, the pizzas and Chinese and Indian and Mexican, whatever you want. Okay, build me a house. Oh, he builds him a huge palace. He used to have a small little hut. Now he has a huge palace. Wow, it has 24 rooms. But he's finished in 10 minutes. You know, now I need more work. Okay, bring me new clothes. Oh, he brings him clothes. Bring me money. Okay, which currency you want? Dollars, rubles, rupees, all the world's pesos, everything is there. And now he's running out of work. You know, what he says, bring me this. And the genie brings him, and poor guy gets scared. Now he can't think of anything more. And the genie starts chasing. So he's running after to the master, and the genie is after him. And he falls at the master's feet and says, please save me, save me. He said, what happened? He says, this genie is going to eat me up. I cannot think of what, you know, after a while you run out of things. So master said, I knew that will happen. So he says, please save me. Tell me what to do. He says, master says, I'll tell you what to do. You have a lot of work for him? He says, yeah. He says, okay, what you do is ask him to erect a tall pole in front of your house. Okay. And then when you have work for him, you tell him, do this work, do that work. But when you have no work, tell him go up and down the pole and keep going up and down, up and down, up and down. So the genie will be busy, you know, going. He needs work, right? You tell him go up and down the pole. And then when you need him to do, bring lunch. Okay, genie, stop going up and down. He'll bring lunch for you. And that's how the man was happy. But the moral of this story, why we are telling it here, is that the mind is like a genie. Whatever you put your mind to, you can get. You know, which is true. Like when I decide I'm going to a child, you tell the child, look, you can be whatever you want to be. You want to be a great athlete, you can be a great athlete. You want to be a good student, you want to be an artist, you want to be a writer. Just put your mind to it. And that is what we tell our children. Once you have full determination and full strong desire, your mind can reach anywhere. So the mind is like a genie. But the problem with the mind is that, you know, they say the empty mind is a devil's workshop. You know, that's what we heard when we were little kids. So a mind that is not utilized becomes a danger, and it can eat you up. And if I have nothing to do, then my mind starts thinking of all, you know, evil things to do, or all wrong things to do, or all mistakes to commit, or how can. So they say the mind that is utilized should be utilized well, should be utilized in serving the world, should be utilized in serving the Lord. But when the mind does not have anything to do, then you tell the mind, start chanting the name of the Lord. Just as the genie was going up and down, so same way the mind that has nothing to do, you say, I don't have anything to do. So instead of turning on the TV and watching some soap opera, just close your eyes and chant the name of the Lord. And so keep your mind busy, keep your mind occupied, keep your mind thinking. But the chanting has to be done with attention. It cannot be done mechanically, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, not like that. But when I'm chanting the name of the Lord, I think of the Lord's form, I think of all his beautiful qualities, I think of, and fill my mind with that. So that then when I'm chanting, I not only see the Lord's form outside, but I also see the Lord's form inside. So chant it with attention. That's why he says, Yajna Naam Japa Yajnyosmi. That is the most powerful way to reach. Then he says, Thavara Naam Himalaya. And among the stationary objects, among the objects that do not move, I am the Himalayas. Now the Himalayas in India, in the north, is a huge mountain range that extends for a few thousand miles. And Gurudev in his commentary says that that is where all the rivers, the major rivers of North India, they arise in the Himalayas. The Ganges, the Brahmaputra, all the major rivers, even the rivers that go to China, the Yangtze, they all arise in the Himalayas. Also the great rishis in the past used to sit in the Himalayas, they used to meditate, and they realized there is a lot of spiritual energy. Actually, we had the good fortune to go with Swami Ishwarananda to Kailash, Mount Kailash, which is in Tibet. And that place is so spiritual. I mean, just the whole journey, because it takes a week to reach, and you have to go in the jeep, and there is no road. It is all off-road driving, very bumpy, and it goes through rivers, little streams, and it goes through rocks, and you are sleeping in tents, and it sometimes rains. It's, you know, Arun went with us. It's a very treacherous journey, but reaching that place is so beautiful that you really feel that there is some powerful force. So that is the glory of the Himalayas, that, you know, so much of the nutrients and so much of the plants and animals and even the herbs, you know, that people use in Ayurveda grow in the Himalayas. So that's why he says, among all the mountains, I am Himalaya. And that is true. Himalayas are the mountains. When you go up to a mountain and you see the majesty and the size, it reminds you of him. You know, that how big and how grand and how wonderful he is. Another meaning I was reading of the Himalayas, that just as the Himalaya has many ranges, you know, there's like Kanchenjunga and, you know, like that. There are smaller mountains, and then you climb, and then finally you reach the top, Mount Everest, which is the tallest mountain in the world. So our mind has many layers. You know, initially you want to conquer your mind, so you go to the lower, the grosser things, like anger, greed, arrogance, hatred, jealousy, you know. So that is the smaller mountains. And then you climb a little higher mountains where I develop love and I develop compassion. And I, you know, so that is a little, you have removed the negative and then you have filled your mind with positive, sharing and giving. And then you have to go a little higher where then a little ego can arise. You know, I am the greatest servant of the Lord. The Lord should be so pleased with me because I do so much. So that little ego arises, the subtle ego, or the spiritual ego. You know, I am more spiritual than this person. I have read more scriptures, or I can say I can give talks. So I am better than all these people. So that kind of an ego very quickly arises. Or I go to the temple 5 days a week and he only goes 2 days a week. So that spiritual ego, one has to be very cautious. Just think that whatever I am doing, I am the servant of the Lord. He has put me in this position. He is working through me. Don't even have that slightest ego that you are the doer. And so that subtle ego is another mountain to cross, because you have to watch out, because that can very quickly nullify all your spiritual sadhana. The moment the ego comes, then your spirituality goes down. And then the highest mountain is the separateness, where I think of God and I being separate. So once you cross that Mount Everest, then you become one with that. Like when you go up on Mount Everest and they say you can see the all around, so beautiful. So that is the highest peak. So that's why he says, Sthavaranam Himalaya. Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha, Sarve Santu Niramayaha, Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.